And we have a time allocation.
Yes, sure. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jordan Kimura, and I represent the represent Appellant Cross Appellee Hawaii Management Alliance Association.
Counsel, I can tell you right now I'm having trouble hearing you. If you might speak up a bit, it would be helpful to me.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
That's a lot better. Thank you.
Together with me in the court is David Minkin. I am sharing 5 of my 15 minutes with Amicus HMSA, and I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honors, there are 2 issues at stake here. The first is the issue of remand, and the second is the issue of conflict preemption under Section 502A of ERISA. I'd like to first focus the attention on conflict preemption under Section 502A. And here, the district court committed reversible error by failing to find that the state statutes relied upon by Mr. Rudell were preempted due to their conflict with the exclusive remedial scheme set forth in Section 502A of ERISA. This is notwithstanding the district court's finding that portions of 663-10 of the Hawaii Revised Statutes do in fact duplicate, supplement, and supplant an ERISA 502A remedy. But the district court then limited this finding to a complete jurisdictional analysis for removal purposes. And this holding is inconsistent with this circuit's decision in Fossen versus Blue Cross Blue Shield, wherein the Ninth Circuit, citing Pilot Life Insurance Company versus Dodeaux, a U.S. Supreme Court case from 1987, held that preemption due to a conflict with ERISA's exclusive remedial scheme set forth in Section 502A of ERISA defeats a state law cause of action on the merits. The circuit also held that whether or not the state statute is exempt from 514 express preemption, it may still be conflict preempted under Section 502A. Also helpful to this analysis is the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Rush Prudential versus Moran, a 2002 decision where the U.S. Supreme Court held that a state may provide for a type of review that would so resemble an adjudication as to fall within Pilot Life's categorical bar.
So I have a question, just sort of a housekeeping question. Is it true that the parties stipulated that if we find that Hawaii statutes are the relevant rule of decision, then HMAA's lien is not valid?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, it's not that it's not valid. It's that HMAA would take nothing by its lien because the process in which 663-10 requires a health insurer to go through the lien determination process results in a limitation as far as the amount that would be paid to the lien holder out of the amount of correspondence.
So what was the exact stipulation then?
Your Honor, I believe the stipulation was that HMAA would take nothing under its lien.
Because you can't demonstrate a windfall, right?
That's correct. That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
And so Section 431, 13-103A10 and 663-10 not only provide for the type of review that would resemble an adjudication, it actually is an adjudication that supplants 502A. Accordingly, regardless of whether or not any portion of Section 431-13-103A10 or 663-10 of the Hawaii Revised Statutes is saved from preemption under 514B2A, these state statutes provide that type of adjudicatory review that should have been preempted on the merits.
Well, so Section 431 explicitly says it governs the practices in the business of insurance, quote unquote, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So how does this not fall into the exception under ERISA 514B for the state law that regulates insurance?
Well, we would submit that the first portion of 431-13-103A10, which prohibits a health insurer from refusing to provide or limiting coverage available to an individual because the individual may have a third-party claim for recovery of damages, would be saved under 514B2A. The problem with 431-13-103A10 is that it then references HRS Section 663-10, and it provides this adjudicatory process that health insurers need to go through to have their liens determined. And that adjudicatory process in 663-10 provides for discovery and investigative abilities to the lien holder if the lien holder is a mutual benefit society like HMAA or an HMO. And that process results in a judgment. It results in a judgment that sets forth the amount due to the lien holder to be paid out of the amount of corresponding special damages recovered in a judgment or settlement. Your Honors, this is not the first time where we have had a insurance statute that references an adjudicatory process. And in fact, the Hawaii Management Alliance Association case versus Insurance Commissioner, which is a Hawaii Supreme Court decision in 2004, relied on the holding in Rush Prudential to hold that the state external review statute in the insurance code was conflict preempted due to its reference to the Hawaii Administrative Procedures Act codified in Chapter 91 of the Hawaii Revised Statutes. That right contained in the insurance statute of either party to seek judicial review under Chapter 91 from the external review process ultimately doomed that statute, and the Hawaii Supreme Court determined that that statute, the insurance code statute that allowed for the external review, that allowed for the judicial review under Chapter 91 of the Hawaii Revised Statute, was preempted on the merits.
Well, so the Secretary of Labor filed an amicus brief in support of neither party's position, but they're requesting an affirmance, right? They're not saying they're for either of you, but they're saying you're wrong, essentially.
Well, they're saying that the district court correctly decided the removal arguments. However, they are also agreeing with the district court as far as the preemption analysis is concerned. And the problem with that briefing, Your Honor, is that it doesn't take into account the fact that 663-10 sets forth this adjudicatory process. The Third Circuit decision in Singh in 2003 painted a clear distinction between a state substantive insurance law, which, if saved, will provide a relevant rule of decision in an ERISA enforcement action, and a state judicial remedy, which is conflict preempted under Section 502A of the Hawaii Supreme Court's decision in Pilot Life, even if it was created or authorized by a state insurance statute. In that case, the Maryland anti-subrogation statute could provide the relevant rule of decision because it did not create a new claim or remedies or enlarge the remedies prescribed in Section 502A. That is not the case here. 663-10 does provide an adjudicatory process that falls within Pilot Life's categorical bar.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Diane Winterbrook, it's for Amicus Curiae, Hawaii Medical Service Association.
Good morning. So what's your interest in this case?
HMSA, if I can use that abbreviation, is the largest provider of ERISA health insurance in the state of Hawaii. I also was counsel for HMSA in the Nutzel decision. HMSA litigated that to a decision by Judge Susan Okimolwe, the decision where she concluded that these statutes were preempted. So HMAA graciously invited us to participate in this case as an amicus curiae so that we can attempt to defend the decision that Judge Mulway reached in the Nutzel case.
So now, since you have just a little over 4 minutes, what's your best shot?
Your Honor, the problem with what the district court in this case did mm-hmm. was that it reframed the insurance code provision in such a way that the court would not have to do the conflict preemption analysis under Pilot Life.
I have a question about that, so I really appreciate you raising it. Are you, let me just ask sort of very basically, in some parts of the briefing, these statutes are bifurcated and discussed separately, and other places we're urged to view this as one animal. As a state statute that defines a way, you know, a type of an unfair claims practice. So which way should we view it?
Your Honor, I think a reference to the district court's decision in this case is a good way to frame that. The extended discussion by the district court of the Hawaii legislative history mm-hmm. and the decision in Yukimoto, which was, of course, a non-ERISA case, indicates that the judge was far more focused on what the legislature intended to do between those two statutes than on what the legislature in fact did, What the legislature, in fact, did in the insurance code was force ERISA plans to pop over to state court and subject itself to that alternate adjudicatory remedy under 663-10. Now, the Hawaii legislature could do that, but it has not. And the district court cannot do that in the guise of interpreting these statutes. The insurance code provision does not simply incorporate a limitation on reimbursement to special damages. That's not what HRS 431.13.103.A.10 says. What it says is you can get reimbursement if you go over to the state court and participate in that state court proceeding to judgment and prove that your lien is not, that there is a duplication of damages. So it's the incorporation of the process in the insurance code provision.
A state process that allows an opportunity to show that there's a windfall, that there has been a windfall, an impermissible windfall.
Which the district court in this case concluded clearly did conflict with ERISA. So by incorporating in six...
Well, it supplements ERISA. That's your problem, right? It's a supplement.
And excuse me for the shorthand.
That's okay, but I'm the one interrupting you. Forgive me, but I'm trying to make sure that I understand your argument, which is that that is the way, I think, that because it's this additional, what you view as a separate remedy, that's the way in which this is impermissibly conflicts.
I use the term conflict because conflict preemption under mm-hmm. pilot life mm-hmm. focuses on whether the state law duplicates, supplements, or supplants.
And well, it certainly doesn't duplicate, right? And whether it supplements or – but it seems to me that's just the gist of your argument.
It is, Your Honor. The district court found that the 663-10 process supplemented uh-huh. the remedies under Section 502A and yet failed to conclude that the insurance code provision – conflicted with ERISA by forcing ERISA plans to go through that preempted process in 663-10. He reframed the statute as if only the limitation was incorporated into the insurance code rather than this entire preempted process.
Wouldn't it have been possible for him to conclude that this was a claim that could have been brought in federal court, so it must have been brought in federal court, and that it wasn't an independent of a plan, so that it's a five... So the claim, you know, just move it to federal court and proceed and go all the way through the analysis to 514 and then decide a la Davila at the very end of the analysis that we have to circle back and view this all in light of 502?
Yes, absolutely. And I think one of the problems is that the judge does appear to have only used the 502A analysis on the complete preemption.
On the end of the decision tree. It just sounded initially that you're tacking this argument to the top of the decision tree. I think it's at the bottom. You get to the same place, but you've answered my question, and I appreciate
yes,
your
absolutely.
Patience.
We agree that the statute was completely preempted. And the problem, we think, is that the court avoided doing the conflict preemption analysis under pilot life with Section 502A by rewriting, if you will, the insurance code provision to do something that arguably would not be objectionable under ERISA.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired, but if you have a few more thoughts you want to share with us, that's fine.
I wanted to be sure I was able to address any questions the court might have on what the district court had summarily characterized as the summary conclusion of the fellow jurist in the Nutzel case. Essentially, because the Nutzel court concluded that there was no cause of action under the insurance code. There is no private right of action under the insurance code. That was not the genesis of plaintiff's claim. Therefore, the only claim was under 663-10, which that court concluded was expressly preempted. That was all included in the orders on remand, and therefore, the court did not feel it needed to go any further than the arguments made in the remand orders in order to conclude that the case should be dismissed on the merits. And granted, it would have been helpful if she had showed her work. I think that would have been helpful to the district court in this case. But if the court has no further questions, I thank you for allowing me to participate as amicus curiae.
Thank you.
Good morning, and as we say here in Hawaii, aloha. I'm Alan Williams. May it please the court. Alan Williams, attorney, one of the attorneys representing plaintiff, appellee, and cross-appellant, Randy Rudell. This can be very complex under ERISA, or it can be very simple. Mr. Rudell And all we need to do is look to the stipulation, which was the final adjudication of what Mr. Rudell was asking the court in the Third Circuit, is under Hawaii law, all health insurers have a right of reimbursement. All health insurers have a right of reimbursement. All health insurers have a right to obtain information from their insured about any third-party case. All health insurance carriers must provide benefits even though there is a pending third-party case. That is Hawaii insurance law. Mr. Rudell was exercising his obligation to have that provision of the law. All health insurance companies are entitled to a right of reimbursement. That's what the statute says. The stipulation is clear. Under Hawaii law, HMAA has a right of reimbursement. Under Hawaii law, Mr. Rudell recovered money, and HMAA agrees that Mr. Rudell, through the unfortunate situation, limited insurance and the horrific injuries, his recovery did not include any amount that corresponds or duplicates what
So what's your best argument for why Mr. Rudell's claims are not completely preempted under ERISA Section 502A based on the two-prong test outlined in Aetna versus Davila?
Two issues on that. 502A, Judge Seabright was very specific on the remand that Mr. Rudell could have brought this action under 502A, A1B. A1B is not a 503A3 action. So Mr. Rudell was not seeking benefits under the policy, which he did, by the way, in the first Rudell, applying Hawaii law when he filed, when HMAA said we're not providing benefits because you have a third-party case. And we cited in the record, Mr. Rudell filed an ERISA action because he was asking the court to have the administration pay benefits, tell the administrators what to do, okay, and to look at the plan document. That was dismissed when, and by the way, HMAA told Mr. Rudell, by the way, you have to comply with the Hawaii Insurance Code 431. So coming back to the question, Mr. Rudell was not seeking benefits under the plan.
He was seeking unencumbered benefits, right?
It's not even unencumbered. The first determination is that if, Your Honor used the term windfall, Hawaii is clear. No plaintiff shall receive duplicate recovery. If a health...
I understand that, but this is the part I know, so I'm not understanding the distinction you're trying to make in response to Judge Callahan's question, please.
But Mr. Rudell was not seeking benefits under the policy, nor were there unencumbered benefits. If Mr. Rudell's recovery included an amount that belonged to HMSA or HMAA, that's HMAA's money. It has nothing to do with unencumbered or anything. You look at the pot, and you determine, is there any amount that duplicates what HMAA paid? And that's the only question, and HMAA agrees.
So the Department of Labor agrees with you in part, but not in part?
The
Department of Labor doesn't agree with you on that point, right?
Well, because it's a mischaracterization of why Mr. Rudell was filing the petition. Mr. Rudell is obligated. Remember, in the Yukimoto decision, the Hawaii Supreme Yukimoto versus Tawarahara, the Hawaii Supreme Court made it clear that in Hawaii, all health insurers have a right of reimbursement under Hawaii law. Whether it's in your contract or not, it's irrelevant. All health insurers that pay benefits in a third-party situation shall have a right of reimbursement. And that's what the petition was seeking to do.
Well, but the dispute seems to be grounded in whether the HMAA plan allowed HMAA to be reimbursed for an award from a third-party settlement. So how is the dispute not governed by ERISA and the HMAA plan terms?
Because under Hawaii law, you don't have to have a contract that requires reimbursement. Under Hawaii law, all health insurers are required or have a right of reimbursement under Hawaii law, under Hawaii insurance law. No matter whether it, and take it one step further, if the plaintiff is unable to or it does not follow the statute, then he is barred from using that statute for a determination of what the right of reimbursement is. So under Hawaii law, regardless of whether it's in a plan brochure, a plan document, a summary plan, it's irrelevant. In Hawaii, all health insurers have a right of reimbursement, which is set forth in the stipulation that we talked about. So the only question, and in fact, if the case is in litigation, the Hawaii court cannot dismiss the case, either by judgment or stipulation, without first making sure that that right of reimbursement is exercised. All health insurers have a right of reimbursement, regardless of what documents or plans or anything says. I hope, Your Honor, that I answered the question. We have spent many pages in our brief explaining the mischaracterization, the misunderstanding of this concept. This had nothing to do with asking the plan to pay money, to tell the administrator to do something, or to rule that the plan somehow was deficient or invalid. Under Hawaii law, you don't even look at a plan. Again, I come back to this. All health insurance companies have a right of reimbursement, no matter what, plain and simple. And plaintiffs have to recognize that, and the courts have to recognize that. And by the way, it is not the insurance code, which incorporates the recovery statute or the lien review statute, says any court of competent jurisdiction may.
So under your analysis here, why doesn't your client have to give part of what he recovered back to the insurance company?
He does. Under our analysis, he does, so long as there's a determination, either by agreement or a evidentiary hearing, whether any part of that recovery belongs to HMAA, duplicates or corresponds to what they paid. That's what the court needs to determine. If this was HMAA has an absolute right to recover in a third part.
Partial right. It's special partial. Damages only. Yeah.
Right.
They don't have a right to get general damage, recover from general damages that are not designated as special damages that duplicate what they paid.
Exactly. So
when you keep saying they have a right to reimbursement, I just go, well, not exactly.
Well, they have a right of it is a right of reimbursement, but from only that portion of the recovery that duplicates or corresponds
right,
to
right, and the problem that the opposing counsel has been stressing now very forcefully is that the mechanism that the state statutory scheme provides for, that adjudicatory mechanism, is something that supplements ERISA. It's not in there. So that's, for me, that's the hub of the argument.
Again, we come back to what in civil enforcement are we talking about? Are we talking about 502A1B, which is to seek benefits under the policy, which Mr. Rudell did in his first action? He filed an ERISA action applying Hawaii law.
So under the district court, if we were to affirm the district court, because the district court denied summary judgment, because you're both cross appellants and appellees or whatever on those. So the practical effect of the denial of summary judgment to the other side, where does that leave your client?
There's a determination that under Hawaii law, none of the proceeds duplicate what they paid.
Remember, so how is that different than under a remand?
Under a remand, the court would make that make that determination, just what portion of the recovery duplicates what was paid, or I mean what.
So how's it different? I'm just trying to understand, how's it different for your client if we affirm the district court than if it's remanded?
Because
that issue still, either way, the district judge here leaves open some determination as to what part your client gets to keep, right?
We believe that this is not a 502A13 action.
Well, I'm trying to figure out just practically, why is it more favorable for you to be in state court than in federal court here?
Because there would be no jurisdiction in federal court.
I know, but the insurance company didn't win in federal court. They didn't get summary judgment. So what's left to determine if we affirm the district court here?
So there's two issues. Number one, whether this case should have been in federal court in the first place, and then the second.
Well, in the summary judgment part, what's still left to be determined in the district court?
Nothing.
Because of the stipulation.
Yes.
Because of the stipulation.
Right. It adjudicates.
I understand your argument to be that you never wanted to be in federal court, and you won in federal court, and so you're preserving your right to go back to state court if we don't agree with, our view of preemption is different. I think what Judge Callahan is saying, why are you seeking to go back to state court now when you won in federal court?
Because we do not truly believe that this falls under the 502A13B civil enforcement provision, seeking benefits under the policy.
But I'm just trying to ascertain the practical effect for Mr. Rudell here.
Well, the practical effects, they go back to state court, they litigate there.
Well, the stipulation would enter into the stipulation too.
Yeah.
So we're not asking.
Your ultimate position is that no part of the settlement, that the settlement did not contain any special damages.
That's correct, factually. Factually.
Well, by agreement.
By agreement that they could not show that he recovered anything other than general damages. That was the effect of what they were saying. Again, we come back to this. We are not asking, and to one quick point, on the Singh, Ariana, Levain, Worth cases, those were all asking the court to do something in regards to the plan, either ordering the plan to reimburse the plaintiffs or enjoining the plan and penalize the plan. We are not asking the plan to do anything. And by the way, we are disputing whether there is, this is not a 502A3 action. HMAA has not filed an action to recover benefits under the plan.
Preemption is just a little trickier than anyone ever wants to admit.
Unfortunately, with ERISA, it can become complex, or as we come back again, this is simple. We are not asking for the plan to pay us anything, Mr. Rudell. We are not asking the court to tell the administrator to do anything. Neither are we telling the court to rule on any sort of contractual or plan document. That has nothing to do, because under Hawaii law, it's plain and simple. All insurance companies have a right of reimbursement. Factually, it must be determined whether the recovery, in fact, duplicates that amount. This has nothing to do with asking the plan to do anything.
The Department of Labor doesn't agree with you, do they?
By again, mischaracterizing or misunderstanding the nature of Hawaii law. Yukimoto versus Tawahara, the Hawaii Supreme Court made it clear that under Hawaii law, all health insurance carriers have a right of reimbursement. That is the statutory right. It was based upon and included in the insurance code based upon the determination of the legislature for a myriad of reasons. My time is up right now. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, counsel. We'll hear rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. Mr. Rudell cites to the Yukimoto decision, of the Hawaii Supreme Court. The problem with the Yukimoto decision is that it didn't involve an ERISA plan. The Yukimoto decision involved a sponsored plan by the state of Hawaii. Here, however, the plan between HMAA and Mr. Rudell's employer is an ERISA plan. That has never been disputed by Mr. Rudell. And if it's an ERISA plan, there is no right to reimbursement in the plan, then there's no right to reimbursement at all.
Could I refocus your question? I'm over here. Just a bit. If I decide that just for my scorecard that I think this case needed to go forward under our authorities, needed to go forward in federal court, agree with the district court about that, and then further agree with the district court's analysis under 514B, under the Kentucky Association test. Right. If I get to that, then I was asking your colleague a minute ago about this cautionary note, what I think of as a cautionary note at the end of Davila, that we circle back, post-Ward. We had one sort of line of case law up until Ward, I think, and then Davila seems to me to really change the discussion. And as this, what I view a cautionary note to circle back to 502. But I think there what that opinion is talking about, and it's a little slippery, but I think it's talking about another cause of action. There's other places in the case law where it talks about a claim, a different claim, and that's inherently ambiguous because we don't know if we're talking about a claim under the plan or a claim is in a cause of action. But at the end of Davila, I think that Justice Thomas, writing for the court, is pretty clearly speaking about a cause of action. I guess that's not really a question, but I think, if I'm understanding your earlier argument, that you're analogizing or equating the Hawaii's adjudicatory process to a separate cause of action. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor. And I would also...
Well, why is that a fair assumption, that it's really a separate cause of action? It's a way to figure out whether there's been a windfall, but can you kind of... For me, that's the nub of it.
Well, it's a cause of action in a sense that you have to go through an adjudicatory process, and it results in a judgment.
We're going to result in a judgment no matter where we land up here because it's a declaratory relief, so that doesn't help me very much.
Well, the order would also declare what the lien holder is entitled to under 663-10.
Hawaii is trying to, it seems to me, announce that this is a combination of an unfair claims practice and a tort reform statute, right? There just certainly isn't going to be any windfall or double recovery. Hawaii has indicated that that's its very clear intent, and there has to be a way of figuring that out. And here what we have, tragically, is damages, special damages that are so high that the insurance company, as I see it, is just not taking that on, not really even contesting it. They couldn't show that because I think available limits were $1.5 million. But that's really just a function of what happened here, and we have to look a little farther about the way this scheme is supposed to work out. So that still just brings me, right, whether there's a stipulation or not here, it still brings me back to trying to figure out whether or not it's fair to characterize the Hawaii's mechanism for enforcing this rule as a separate cause of action. And I think I understand you to say that you agree that Davila is really looking for, suggesting we can't have a separate cause of action, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
That would be consistent with another case that we have as authored by Judge Fletcher. Forgive me for not remembering the name of it. It's the case that turns on whether there was an oral contract, a telephone call to the insurance company, and he said, well, this isn't a 502 action at all. It's not. They're not looking for benefits that arise out of the plan at all. There was apparently, allegedly, a telephone call, so it was an oral contract situation, right? So that this case law seems to really reinforce that we're looking for a separate claim in the sense of cause of action, not a mechanism to determine whether or not there was in fact a windfall.
Well, I think it's also helpful to remember, Your Honor, that if we are looking at 502A without regard to the Hawaii statutes, then we are looking at as to what the plan provides, and that would be the cause of action, because under
what would be the cause of action?
The plan says
you can't do this. The plan says we're going to be reimbursed off the top every time.
Right.
Basically.
It does, right.
So what would be the cause of action?
Well, the cause of action would be the adjudication of the lien, and it would be pretty much, I would suppose, an open and shut matter.
I don't understand what you mean. I'm asking very literally what the cause of action would be. You mean just a declaratory relief that the plan says that?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that would be open and shut, end of story?
Yes, Your Honor.
So the Hawaii statute Hawaii legislature wouldn't be allowed to limit in this way the way an insurer can do business in Hawaii?
To the extent that it creates an adjudicatory process.
Correct, Your Honor. So in your view of the world, and I don't mean to be provocative here, but I think in your view of the world, Hawaii wouldn't be allowed to have the earlier statute that was enforced in this case, the statute that said you can't condition benefits upon or withhold benefits on the basis that somebody may or may not have access to third-party recovery.
No, Your Honor, because that statute is actually safe from preemption, and we would submit that it's safe from preemption under 514b2a.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you both. Thank all of you for your arguments this morning. The case just heard will be submitted for decision.